I think it is clear to believe in the power of ideas.
Fresh thank you to the Manhattan Institute.
I'm Jim Copeland, the director of the Center for Legal Policy at the Manhattan Institute. And it's my pleasure to welcome you here today to our program on the criminalization of corporate conduct. Criminalizing what corporations do is something that was really foreign to American law as little as 100 years ago. But until 1909, a corporation couldn't be held criminally liable. Since then, we've seen an explosion of corporate criminal liability over the last century. And we see now a number of critiques of this trend that have emerged. The traditional protections, substantive and procedural, for defendants have been eroded. Corporations spend millions or billions of dollars on compliance programs, which may or may not protect the corporation and the individual corporate executives from prosecution. We see an erosion of the attorney-client privilege as we've seen it evolve over a series of memoranda emanating from the Federal Justice Department, beginning with now Attorney General Eric Holder back when he was a deputy attorney general in the Clinton administration. We've seen a proliferation of federal laws, now numbering over 4,000 federal criminal laws into what was originally a province of state law. And we've seen long dormant state laws, such as the Martin Act here in the U.S., here in New York, being adopted by prosecutors like the then Attorney General Elliot Spitzer in finding fault with varieties of corporate behavior. To analyze this more fully, we've got a couple of distinguished guests and a distinguished interviewer. This is the third Manhattan Institute program in which we're working cooperatively with our friend J.P. Donlan, the editor-in-chief of Chief Executive Magazine, a magazine that the J.P.'s worked at not consistently, but worked at for over 30 years now. He became the editor-in-chief of that magazine in the early 1980s, built it to really being the leading magazine or the distinctive magazine in the country, catering to chief executives of corporations. He's in the midst of that service, left and done some other things, including heading Directorship Magazine for a while. He's now back as editor-in-chief of Chief Executive, and the Manhattan Institute is very happy and proud to partner with JP on a series of forums on items of interest to business leaders and executives. JP will be talking with two of the preeminent leaders in the United States on this topic, one who hails from the area of law, one who hails from the area of business. The Honorable Dick Thornburgh is someone who's known to most of you, if not personally, certainly by reputation. He was the governor of the state of Pennsylvania and earned substantial acclaim in shepherding that state through the Three Mile Island crisis. He later served in the Justice Department and as Attorney General of the United States under Presidents Reagan and Bush, and he has been active in the private field of law as well. He's now of counsel with the K&L Gates law firm, and he's worked with a number of corporate defendants in precisely the sorts of criminal actions we'll be talking about today. Kenneth G. Langone is a distinguished leader in investing and in business leadership. He's an all-American story, growing up just outside the city here, and a self-made man who became the founder and chairman of Invamed Associates. He famously did the initial public offering for Ross Perot's Electronic Data Systems, creating another very wealthy man, and he famously co-founded the Home Depot stores, which all of you are familiar with, one of the nation's largest retail chains. He also, in his professional capacities as a business leader and as a director, has faced head on prosecutors both at the federal and state level, and therefore has a lot of experience from the business side of things that he's going to expose us to today. So. So with that, there's a fuller bio that you could have picked up. I'm not going to give lengthy introductions of these gentlemen that really need no introduction to this audience. I just ask you all, please, to quiet your cell phones or beepers so that we can have your full attention for this recorded event. And I'm going to turn it over to my friend, J.P. Dunlin. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. As Jim has indicated, criminal law has strayed very far from its historical roots. Many statutes have punished those whose acts are wrongful only by virtue of legislative determination. And the distortion of the classical criminal law has arisen for a variety of reasons, some of which may have been accompanied by benign motives. But for example, you know, the Enron scandal and similar acts of intentional corporate fraud have led to overly broad proposals that may trap honest but unsuspecting executives. So, however it's arrived at, the unintended consequences is to trap CEOs and business executives and alter their decisions. All of you are familiar, no doubt, with what has happened to Arthur Andersen in the wake of the Enron scandals. A venerable firm of many years was destroyed because it could not withstand the allegations that were impugned to the entire firm, even though it was only the Houston partners that were actually under indictment. Also, perhaps the most egregious example, that in the wake of the tech bubble, then Attorney General Elliot Spitzer identified a number of insurance companies and mutual fund companies, banks and others. In fact, he targeted Merrill Lynch with allegations that they were selling inflated shares to firms for which they were getting investment banking fees, and they extracted $100 million fines paid to the government, not to the investors. But it's not just those highlighted examples. I mean, there were companies in the Midwest, like a healthcare firm called WellCare, which had visited upon itself and federal investigators and lost 3/4 of its market value, even though the investigators never even announced why they were there, what they were doing. So this has a number of ramifications for business, not the least of which are the decision making and the consequences for the economy. So I'm going to ask my friend Dick, how did we get into this mess?
Start from the beginning. Eh? Well, I have to acknowledge I've worked both sides of the streets on this issue. I've been a prosecutor and I've been a defense lawyer for corporations who have tangled with the U.S. Department of Justice. So I think I have a somewhat balanced view of how we got here and what we might do to reduce some of the pressure on some of the mainsprings of our free enterprise system. I think the thing that's important when you look at corporate liability, you recognize that corporations are artificial entities. They're not like the rest of us in our daily lives. They have powers and they acquire certain characteristics only from the laws that create them. And that makes them, in the view of those disposed against them, fair game for most anything that comes along. So about 100 years ago, the Supreme Court of the United States was faced with the question of whether or not a corporation as such had any liability under the criminal laws for activities that it undertook. Up to that time, as part of the common law, there was a doctrine that lawyers will recognize, and to others I apologize, the doctrine of respondeat superior, that is to say that when an individual worked for you and was acting in your interest and did something wrong, and there was a question of liability, it was not just that person, it was you that had to answer for any harm that was done. This was in 1909 by the Supreme Court transported magically into the criminal area as well. And since that time, we've had a developing field of criminal liability on the corporate side that I think far outstretches what anybody would have expected at the time. One of the reasons, of course, is that corporations are thought to be fair game for populist agitators and for the Ralph Naders and Elliot Spitzers of this world who see an easy target to promote their own personal interests. But what you really have here is a three-part play. While it was the court that originally established the status of corporate liability under the criminal laws, they were aided and abetted, as usual, by the other two branches of government. That is to say that the legislature, the Congress of the United States in particular, embarked on an effort to proliferate criminal liability across the board in every single field in which corporations are active. Part of the progressive movement in the early 20th century, but continuing to this day through Sarbanes-Oxley. That is the notion of creating new liabilities for corporations. And I think that probably the main reason is the unquenchable desire of members of the Congress to do something. They wake up in the morning, they look at the papers and see the headlines or the top of the morning news and see something wrong and they want to do something. Well, what that's resulted in is a proliferation of now over 4,500 separate criminal laws, many of which, if not most of which, apply to corporations. So the courts created the rights, the Congress proliferated, and then the executive branch. And you've gotten, in recent years in particular, a very activist group within the Department of Justice that has sought to expand the presence of the federal government in recognizing wrong on the part of corporations, beginning with, unfortunately, our now Attorney General, Eric Holder, in 1999, and when he was a Deputy Attorney General, and continuing through four other Republican Deputy Attorneys General, guidelines have been set down for the prosecution of corporations in particular situations. Now, let me just take a step back here and remind you that if criminal acts are committed by individuals in the employ of a corporation or not, they have to answer to the criminal law for the consequences. But what's new and different here, of course, is the expansion of that individual liability to corporate liability, as was pointed out in the case of the Arthur Andersen situation, a death sentence for that venerable firm because of the attribution of criminal conduct to the entity itself rather than just the individuals. More about that later on, but I think that's about as quick a history as I can give of how we got to where we are today.
Ken, you've been on the firing line of this. You've actually faced it firsthand. Tell us your own experience of this and how you reacted to it. What were the circumstances? And
let me first correct the very generous and gracious introduction. And I do this because I think it's important. I'm not a self-made man, and I've never met a self-made man. All of us, one way or another, are dependent on each other in many different ways. And I'd like to think I was self-made, but in the cold light of day, I had an awful lot of people helping me along the way, so I think they deserve as much of the credit as I do. But let me address this issue. I think the biggest mistake we make is to put a party label on it, because I don't think it takes much reminding that the prosecution of Arthur Andersen was under a Republican administration. Everybody's hands are dirty. And I believe this in a very aggressive way. I think that the so-called criminalization of corporate behavior is one more example of self-interest. The lawyers that become high-priced defenders, I don't mean to give you tight shoes, Governor, but the lawyers, and I'm not a lawyer, so I guess I can have a field day with this one. The lawyers who get very high fees because people go to them on the basis that they understand how the other side works. I think it's more than a coincidence when you look at the number of great names. And there's one lawyer in particular that I have enormous respect for because he didn't do it. And that's our Chancellor of Education here in New York, Joel Klein. He left, he was the head of the antitrust division of the Justice Department, and he's committed the rest of his life to helping kids get a good education in the city. And I might tell you, he's winning. I don't know how you deal with the self-interest there. And then you have our politicians who know that headlines, whether were justified or not, are very helpful at the poll. But the Arthur Andersen thing to me is one of the most, and I believe, too late of course, but I believe that decision was reversed. Too late. So they took a venerable organization. In 1957, when I went to work, Arthur Andersen, Harvey Kapnick was the guy running it. Arthur Andersen was perceived as the icon of the accounting profession. That's when they had the Big Eight. We've allowed in this country unbridled behavior by our elected officials who pander to the public because they're mindful of headlines and what headlines can do for their political careers. I don't know the answer. I know the answer in my case was to simply ask the question, did I do anything wrong? And if I did do anything wrong, then I think the right thing to do would be for me to go up and say, we did something wrong. How do we settle it? But we didn't do anything wrong. And there were two instances at one time for me. There was this organization called FINRA, which on its own decided that my firm had engaged in so-called profit sharing, which was a law created to protect the investor. We got every single client of the firm, every single one, to sign an affidavit that they did not share profits with us. This is to protect them. This is a law that stops people like me from gouging them or taking something, every one of them. And yet, FINRA, which by the way was then run by the person who's now the head of the SEC, Mary Shapiro, on its own decided that they were going to bring a case in any event. 48,000 pages of emails, not one word to support their charge. Not one, not a single fact, not one. It cost me $20 million to defend myself. It's the best $20 million I ever spent. Why? And by the way, during the hearing slash trial, the prosecutor, or the fellow that was arguing the case for the FINRA, ridiculed me to the three-man panel that I was spending this outrageous sum of money to defend myself. Now, tell you some interesting facts about this. Their technique reminds me of Ray Donovan. You remember Raymond Donovan? He was a secretary. You probably knew him, Governor. This was the man who, after he was acquitted, on the courthouse steps said, now where do I go to get my reputation back? See, that's where they get you. In a court, you'll whip them if the facts are on your side. But too often, people are so terrified by the media and the enforcers, and that's what I call them, they're enforcers. They're no different in my mind. Where they're wrong, they're no different than an enforcer in the mafia. None at all, no difference at all. It's coercion, it's high pressure tactics. In my case, they called my attorneys at Wachtell Lipton, who are spectacular. And they told them that if I didn't start talking, it was 20 minutes to 10, that if I didn't start talking settlement by 10 o'clock, they were going to issue a press release. And I, when they, my lawyers had their obligation to tell me, I said, call them back and tell them not to waste the 20 minutes. We beat them badly. It was outrageous. And I'll give you names, because this is how these things happen. There's a very prominent investment man in Philadelphia by the name of John Bogle. John Bogle was an expert witness for FINRA. And they were asking.
Founder of Vanguard.
Yes, it is.
Founder of Vanguard.
John Bogle had the audacity, and I use the word advisedly, that when he was being interviewed or when he was on the stand, they asked him the question, who should firms give hot issues to? And he said, oh, they should only give it to clients. And my attorney was smart enough to say, what about customers? He said, oh no. He said, you can give it to a client, but you can't give it to a customer. And so my attorney said, well, can you help us out? Can you explain the difference? He said, yes, a client is a long-term investor and a customer is a short-term investor. Think of trying to enforce that at Merrill Lynch, where you got 16,000 brokers and the broker's got to say to the person on the phone, well, I have to know, are you a client or a customer before I can give you the stock? But this is the absurdity to which they went. And the way they humiliated this man was disgraceful. And I urge you, you can get, read, it's a 94-page opinion. My satisfaction came when just recently FINRA agreed, because I told them I was going to make a major campaign out of it, that they would no longer issue press releases like the SEC, the same thing. The SEC does not issue press releases until after something is fully. Now, the only exception is if somebody is an embezzler or somebody does criminal things where they feel they have to inform the public to warn the public of further damage. But one of the things I tried to get them to agree that if let's go to the European system, loser pays. That'll stop a lot of this, by the way. This will stop an awful lot of this. But where are we today? We're at a point in time where selfish interests are dictating. And I can tell you, as a businessman, we are going to pay a horrible, horrible price. My partner and I, Bernie Marcus, co-founders of Home Depot with Arthur Blank, we would not be able to found Home Depot today. The rules that are in effect today, yeah, go ahead, that's it. Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
I just want to make a brief point about management. One of the problems in our criminal justice process today is that there's insufficient management and supervision out of the Department of Justice as to what transpires in the U.S. Attorney's offices. And this goes along with what I think Ken's complaint is. I just finished a 3-year representation of a prominent Democrat politician in my hometown of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, who was prosecuted on the flimsiest of charges because of his prominence and because he was a Democrat. And time and again, I would go to the Department of Justice, where I once hung my hat, and point out the inadequacies in this case. And I wouldn't get a tumble. And the problem was that they wanted to take hands off on the prosecutors. The U.S. attorneys, and I was one of them once too, were sacrosanct. Nobody was going to overrule them. And now they're mortally embarrassed because last week, the judge threw the whole case out. But that was after 3 years of an ordeal for a very prominent citizen of my hometown, simply because there wasn't an instinct for taking a second look at a prosecution as it ground forward to determine, is there really anything here? Let me tell you what the crux of a number of these charges was. The charge, this is a big-time corruption case, 43 counts of using the office fax machine for personal purposes. about $4.20 a piece for misusing that fax machine. And the rest of the case wasn't much better. I was embarrassed for the Department of Justice. I was embarrassed for my profession. And most of all, I was appalled at the lack of supervision and management that went into the bringing of that case. And I suspect when you get to these horror stories like Ken described, 95% of them are going to indicate the kind of deficient oversight that no business would tolerate about its field office or somewhere out in the hustings doing something that was totally at odds with what the mission of the organization was. That's my war story for the evening.
Ken, you not just faced this in court, but you actually had this made personal to you with a certain former New York Attorney General who singled you out by name and actually threatened you personally if you went up against him. So is that the way to stop this, is to stand up and be counted and say, stop, you're not going to run over me?
I don't know of any other way. If there's a different way, tell me. But he was a bully. We're talking about Mr. Spitzer.
We are.
Who, by the way, is cranking up. I understand you want to run for Attorney General again. So, No. He is rehabilitating himself. He's got two PR firms, and he's got a political consultant. Okay? Now, he still can't stop lying. But think of this. Think of the number of people he accused of criminal behavior and never brought a case. Never brought one case. There is, and this is again, trial by press. He said, I will tell you right now, my opinion, he destroyed more shareholder value than all the crooks in the last 10 years on the corporate side. All right? But you know what? Everybody was so terrified. You can't imagine the number of people, good friends of mine, that called me to say, why are you doing this? Are you crazy? Go downtown and settle with him and try and work it out. Of course, what he didn't understand was Dick Grasso said, he said, what Spitzer doesn't understand, this is taking 10 years off Ken's life. He's having the time of his life. And you want to know the truth? I enjoyed it. Why did I enjoy it? Because I felt somebody had to fight this bastard. And let me say, and I don't mean to draw a parallel, but I think history's a great lesson. People forget that in 1933, Adolf Hitler was elected through a democratic process. I submit to you, I'm not suggesting that Elliot Spitzer, don't quote me, I'm not saying that, I renounce that. But what this man did with reputations, without regard to the effect on those people's lives, was as destructive behavior. And to this day, now bear in mind, this is law. They had a judge down here by the name of Charlie Ramos, who's never tried a case. He's a Supreme Court judge, and virtually every decision he's made has been reversed on appeal. He's the guy that gave Elliot summary judgment, which was reversed by the appellate division. The Court of Appeals, which is the highest state court in the land, the state, seven people voted 7-0. This is the highest court in the state to throw the case out because the Attorney General had no standing in this case. Spitzer had the audacity to say that the current Attorney General should have appealed the decision of the Court of Appeals of the state of New York. And my question is, appeal to who? To who? But these make heaven. This is the game. And if you don't, look, you know, if you aren't willing to sacrifice some of your rights, you're bound to lose all of your rights. That's how I feel.
Dick, let me ask you, considering what happened to Arthur Andersen and other firms that are not as well known, If you were advising them as their general counsel or of counsel, with the gift of hindsight, how would you advise them to defend themselves in these circumstances?
Well, it's pretty hard, because the power of the Department of Justice and the U.S. attorneys is plenary, and it's often exerted in a way that really constitutes the kind of bullying that Ken described. The real flaw in the Arthur Anderson case was attributing to the entire organization a national, if not international, presence in the auditing field the wrongs that were perpetuated by a small group in the Houston office. And I think that case, while it wasn't the basis for the Supreme Court's reversal of the ultimate finding of guilt against them, pointed out the need for some kind of remedy. And maybe it's a legislative remedy, but more often than not, these things succumb to some good sense and, as I said before, some good management out of the Department of Justice. You would have thought that somewhere along the way somebody would have said, why are you bringing this case against this national, international accounting firm when the wrongdoing that you're alleging was concentrated in one office in Texas? And I think that you have to have an answer to that in order to proceed with it, but they didn't. And what the remedy is there for future activities, I think probably the mortification and embarrassment suffered by the Department of Justice, while it's no recompense for the people thrown out of work and who lost their savings, should impart a little bit of caution. But I wouldn't bet on it, because the players change, time goes on, and people tend to repeat the same mistakes over and over again. So these kinds of things are going to succumb to good leadership, I think. You've got to have the kind of leadership that's willing to say, this is wrong, this should not go forward. The type of case that I described, Ken's case, the Arthur Anderson case, somebody to stand there and put their hand up and say, whoa, let's think about what we're doing here. Clearly that wasn't true in the state of New York when ex-Governor Spitzer was the Attorney General. And frankly, in my career, and I've spent 25 years in law enforcement, I've seen a lot of these headline grabbers. They eventually stumble and fall, as Spitzer did, but they have a heyday while they are in action and supported by the press, and it requires a lot of vigilance and a lot of determination and backbone to stand up to them and make them answer for their wrongs.
Right. Ken, one of the undiscussed ramifications of this is the impact of decision-making in companies who feel at risk from this. For example, the investments not made, the expansion not undertaken. You sit on a number of boards. You must be privy to a lot of discussions where this lurks in the background. And one of the elements that is involved here is that if companies and leaders become risk adverse because of this, this will have economic consequences, employment consequences, consequences for innovation and new investment. Your reaction?
I agree with your observations. Look, and when I say take chances, I don't mean cut corners. If we didn't take chances when we founded Home Depot 30 years ago, we opened up our first two stores 30 years ago last week. But if we didn't take chances, there are 325,000 people today in that company with high-paying jobs, career path opportunities, kids that started as lot boys managing stores, making $150,000, $200,000 a year, one American success story after another. Not us, them, these kids. You have no idea how constricted business decisions are, and how too many times you sit in a boardroom and you let the lawyers dictate your business decisions. I have nothing against lawyers. And I really don't. And I don't want to say throw away best friends of lawyers, because you know what that means. But they are. I have some very close friends. Marty Lipton is like a second father to me. But you got to be careful that you don't so constrict your decisions, your business decisions, that you accomplish the short term at the expense of the long term. And that's happening too much, much too much. I mean, a good example, a wonderful example is General Motors. And one of the things I do with things like this is I give up names. I'm sure people say, yeah, couldn't you be a little more subtle or a little less, a little more political? But that's what I'm bitching about. People are too political. But Ira Milstein, in the early 90s, literally ran General Motors. And his pitch was a divided chairman and CEO. And Ira and I were at a conference together, one that Jeff Sonnenfeld from Yale runs. And I said to Ira, it wasn't very polite, but I said, Ira, help me out. You had your way at General Motors. This is before they went bankrupt, okay? They were just in trouble then. I said, what happened? And he looked me right in the eye. He said, they didn't listen to me. And I said, they didn't listen to you. They did exactly what you told them. This is not about form. This is about substance. You take one of the great business leaders I've ever known, Jack Welch. If Jack was told how to run General Electric, I can guarantee you GE would not have been. Bear in mind, you want the numbers. Jack took it from a $15 billion market cap to a $600 billion market cap in 20 years. Do the math. We need lawyers and we need advice. But at some point, there's business judgment that's got to prevail. And if you fail, it's okay. As long as you fail honestly and with noble intentions when you do it. I had a partner one time who told me he never made a mistake. And I thought, and I said, you know, you're right. He said, you agree? I said, yes. I said, you haven't done a goddamn thing in your life. How can you make a mistake? Think about it. Pardon my French, but I mean, there it is.
Thank you for coming.
I said, just take two propositions. First of all, any CEO takes directions from a lawyer is nuts. Any CEO doesn't consult his lawyer is equally nuts. And one of the things that I'm concerned about, and we've discussed at other sessions of this, is the erosion of the attorney-client privilege, which has been undertaken by a succession of leaders in the Department of Justice, initiated by the now Attorney General. And let me tell you why I'm concerned about that. It's the same reason that the Supreme Court honored the attorney-client privilege extending it to corporate counsel. If you're going to get good advice from a lawyer, you've got to give them all the facts. And some of those can be pretty untidy and pretty unattractive. And that lawyer has to have the veil of protection around him of the attorney-client privilege so he isn't yanked in before a grand jury and asked to testify about some particular act that may be wrongdoing or not. The attorney-client privilege goes back to Elizabethan times. It's probably one of the oldest privileges existing in the law. And yet 10 years ago, it was frontally assaulted under the guise of working out some ways and means by which corporations should be credited with cooperating by giving up the attorney-client privilege. And that means that the next time a lawyer's advice is sought by someone within the corporation, they're going to be more circumspect. They're going to be more indefinite, more vague about certain facts. And I've been a lawyer long enough to know that if your decisions and your opinion and your advice is only as good as the facts upon which they're based, and if they're not forthcoming from the client, the advice is not worth much at all. So there is now before the Senate a bill that would restore the attorney-client to its vigor and do away with this misguided experiment of giving people credit for giving up an important right in determining whether they're not going to be prosecuted or not. But I think that while that's an awfully technical issue, it's not one that's going to grab the front page or the top of the morning news, but it sure as heck is important to people who depend upon lawyers for sound advice.
Before we go to open questions, I wanted to ask our two guests to think about the future. Ken specifically, before the sort of financial meltdown, there was a perceived shift in IPOs away from New York exchanges to London and other places. And much of what I read was because of the complexity of the law and this problem of going after criminality, criminalizing business conduct. You invest in a lot of smaller startups. You don't use a lot of leverage, as I understand it. So you look at the person, you look at the individual. What are you seeing from fledgling companies?
Well, I told the governor last Wednesday, I had a meeting with him, and I told him he was well on his way to destroying the last remaining source of financial strength of this state for the reasons we're talking about. By the way, I want to say this to Governor Thornburgh. I knew him when he was governor. I knew of him, I should say. I spent a lot of time in Pennsylvania. I was a Bucknell trustee. You were a superb governor. And by the way, when you were attorney general, I distinctly remember the fairness that you brought to your job. Tragically, too many of your successors don't have that motive to do the right thing. You know, in America today, running for attorney general of a state is a stepping stone to becoming governor of that state. It's not coincidental. Go look at the number of people that it's almost a progressive step. But I mean this, Governor.
I'd already been governor.
Yeah, well, yeah, but you went to a higher calling, and when you went there, with two presidents, I might add. I always remember the fairness that you brought, and that's all. I think that's all we can expect. But your question is this simple: this is part of what I'm talking about—the terrible price we are going to pay. I'm going to London next week for a week because half my activities are now being done out of Europe. Why would I want to put up with an Elliot Spitzer? It doesn't make any sense.
Dick, what is your sense of the future?
Well, I don't see a very promising future if there aren't three very important reforms undertaken, one of which I've broken my pick on over my career, and that is a true federal criminal code. Now, this is a yawner for most of you, I recognize. But the fact that we have 4,000 plus separate statutes that have been arranged on the statute books higgly-piggly without any sense of organization, when there is a model penal code out there that could act as a template for a sensible criminal code. When I was Attorney General, I went to speak to a prominent legal group, and I renewed my plea about having a reasonable criminal code. Everybody stood up and applauded, and then they went home. And nothing happened. So much for my leadership. But the fact of the matter is we simply have got to make sense out of this law so that you don't need all this twisting and turning over technicalities. Second thing is that there are a huge proliferation of criminal offenses that don't even appear in criminal laws. They are regulatory offenses. When the Congress passes some kind of regulatory law, they almost automatically add as the last part, any violation of the foregoing shall constitute a criminal offense. I have a very good friend who's been in the forefront among reformers in this area, and I want to quote what he suggested. He recommends the enactment of a general statute providing administration sanctions and procedures prohibiting administrative sanctions and procedures for all regulatory features, except in two instances. One is where the conduct involves significant harm to persons, property interests, and institutions. This means not using the wrong form, which is a criminal offense, not using the right wrong colored paper, which could be a criminal offense, but real harm to people. That should be a criminal offense. And I don't think anybody denies that. And the second is equally interesting, it seems to me. Permit criminal prosecutions not for the breach of a regulatory provision, but for a pattern of intentional, repeated breaches. Those two, plus the third, and that is greater supervision by the Department of Justice, over the activities of those who are charged in the front lines with bringing criminal prosecutions, I think would bring some relief. But don't bet on it, folks. It really is a very, it's no sport for the short-winded. And I think those of us who are concerned about seeing these reforms come to pass are less and less in the forefront of the activity. I hope the new generation of lawyers will come along who are inspired to deal with these problems, because they are very serious, and they do have, as Ken points out, an enormous adverse effect on our free enterprise system and the entrepreneurs who make it happen.
Right. Questions from the audience. Microphones will come to you. Yes, this lady in the aisle. Bring a microphone to her, please. Just state your name for the record.
Marta Varell. I guess this is on. Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Okay. My question is kind of a historical one. There was a time in this country where business leaders were looked up to. Not only were they successful as business people, but they were also remarkably charitable, setting up wonderful museums, the Rockefellers, the Fricks, the Mellons, the Langones. I can go on. But is part of the problem that you're talking about not just a problem that has more or less always been with us, that is of overzealous prosecutors with political ambitions, but a problem in a change in the mentality where all of a sudden we find that business is in a defensive position because there's a class warfare element to the criminalization of corporate conduct and the staffing of many, many prosecutors' offices now with people who think of themselves as in the vanguard of a social revolution, not people who are enforcing the law. So I wonder if you'd comment on the class warfare aspects, if any, of the problem.
Dick?
Yeah, I'll take a shot at that. I used to be in politics and then know somewhat what you're referring to. There's always been a populist strain in this country. William Jennings Bryan ran for president an infinite number of times. Based on the notion that the only thing wrong with the country was the banks and Wall Street and the gold standard. But that constituency waxes and wanes with the state of the economy. When the economy goes south and people lose jobs and people are concerned about their future, they begin to look for scapegoats. And you're quite right. That becomes targeted on the folks who have been successful and who are the stalwarts in the community, who are the putative leaders of each segment of society across the country. And it as I say, waxes and wanes. And I think if we have a recovery, as I expect we will, that's not going to be a permanent feature. I don't think the United States, as I've observed it in my lifetime, is ever going to succumb to true class warfare. There are a lot of people out there who would like to promote it, but I think it's going to fall on deaf ears with a good sense of the American people.
Another question over here. The man with glasses? Debbie, just give him a glass.
My name is Jack McKenzie, and as Dick knows, I'm a recovered journalist. I'd like to address the Arthur Andersen case in an aspect that I haven't heard discussed. But before that, I'd like to say preliminarily that it should not have been a shock that in 1909 the Supreme Court got around to recognizing that a corporation could be an individual for the purposes of the criminal law. Half a century earlier, it had recognized corporations as individuals with all the privileges thereof. How about the responsibilities? What's wrong with that? Nothing wrong with that proposition. What happened after that, we can argue about it case by case. As to the Arthur Andersen case, I'm just a consumer of this. I did not report it, but it's my memory that the trouble with the case was that nobody at Arthur Andersen was really authorized, empowered to deal with the government. It was a fractured structure. The shareholders each had, and the officers had their own interests, and nobody could get together and deal with the government. Now, the government should not have taken advantage of that situation the way it did. In my consumer's view, it's not exactly a studied view, but I really think if I were the lawyer for the Arthur Andersen, I would say structure yourself so that you're not victimized this way. And I think Arthur Andersen was responsible for a lot.
Do you have a question relating to this? Or?
Oh, don't you agree?
Jack, I think it's called management. And I think that one of the byproducts of poor management is that uncoordinated response without a focal point for dealing with the government. And that can be fatal. And that's why more in the way of compliance programs and programs that exist in reality and not just on paper for supervising what's going on in some of these vast corporations is necessary. We saw that. I was the court-appointed examiner in the WorldCom bankruptcy. And when you talk about a lack of coordination and a lack of focus, they wrote the book on it and paid a whale of a price for it. So I think that's a principal need for today's corporate managers is to make sure that they are structured so that they don't lose control over all the various components in their organization.
Yeah, but let me add to that. Mm-hmm. I don't think bad management is criminal.
Absolutely.
So the fact that they weren't organized didn't change the fact that there were partners all over the United States of America. Turns out I was on the board of a company. We sold it called Choice Point, and we were a client of Arthur Andersen's in Atlanta, Georgia, and they did a superb job, and they did it right. So the fact that they were ineffective, obviously if they were better at dealing with things, they might have not had the result. But the fact of the matter is, go back to the merits of the case. The fact that I'm incompetent in defending myself doesn't give anybody else the right to go after me and take advantage of the fact that I might be incompetent. That's not what the law is supposed to be about.
That's life.
I understand that, but it doesn't make it right.
Question over here.
Yes, Mark Rush. Full and fair disclosure, I know Dick Thornburg, we're in the same law firm. But the one aspect we didn't talk about today, at least yet, is the judiciary, the federal judiciary's role as gatekeeper to kind of keep prosecutors in check. Once they accuse citizens, corporations, et cetera, we ultimately get in front of a judge. And can we talk about your views on the role of the judiciary and the quality of the federal judiciary anyway in the country today?
Dick? Your department?
Well, you're absolutely right. Recent experience that you and I shared would indicate that a sour judge can really work extreme prejudice to an individual defendant. I think one of the problems that may have been cured by the Supreme Court today was in the enormous amount of financing that is poured in by individuals to popularly elected judges. And there's still a lot of states that still elect their judges, and when there's a partisan campaign, it takes a lot of wherewithal to run that campaign. And in the case that the court decided from West Virginia, they found, and again, I haven't read the opinion, but it's a very far-reaching concept that if a judge has a colorable conflict of interest in a case because his election was largely financed by one of the individuals before him, he ought to recuse himself. Makes pretty good sense to me. But how you're going to police that is a constitutional matter. This was decided on due process grounds, and it's going to make for very interesting reading to see how this is the Massey case that was decided by the Supreme Court just today.
Question in the back.
Hi, Dave Faber is my name. I had a quick question for each of you. One is, in my experience working with a lot of companies in my career, I don't think the senior managements of large corporations in this country fight enough and follow the example that you set as an individual in your case. And they certainly have the wherewithal to do it. And I often think that they are thinking short-term as opposed to long-term when they roll over and join, for example, in my belief, the global warming crowd, Exxon, Duke Power, all for self-interest. So that's a question I'd like to ask you. You serve on a lot of boards. And secondly, for Mr. Thornburg, we've talked about federal prosecutors being out of control, attorney generals, but I don't think there's enough penalty for lawyers that make business companies' lives difficult with tort cases that have been totally fraudulent, and yet you never hear about the lawyers who bring them going to jail.
Ken, are executives milquetoast?
Well, courage is not abundant in corporate boardrooms, okay? I'm frequently asked to comment about the erosion of power from the board to the CEO, that this has transpired over the last 15 or 20 years. A board has one absolute power. It has the right to terminate a CEO. Don't confuse power with courage. There's a difference. Too frequently, board members are intimidated not so much by the CEO as they are by each other because they want to be one of the guys or one of the gals or whatever it is. And sometimes, and I've been in situations where I've led the effort to terminate four CEOs in my career. And I got to tell you, there were times early on in each one of those four instances when I was the equivalent of a skunk at a lawn party. It took a period of time. And initially, I was castigated. I was socially ostracized. I wasn't invited to play golf. I wasn't invited to the night before dinner and all those good things. Ironically, I'm not saying I'm always right because I'm more wrong than I am right, but in these four cases, I was right. So I don't know how you change the makeup of people's sense of self-confidence to be willing to call them as they see them. You know, that's just human nature.
Dick, should there be some sort of sanctions for lawyers who bring frivolous or non-meritorious?
Well, you think one of the heartening things to me, and I don't wish these people well, is the fact that several of the top plaintiff's lawyers in the country who have been in the forefront of class action suits have gone to jail and are there today, including Bill LaRocque and Dickie Scruggs, who probably were the most prominent high-profile plaintiff's lawyers in the country. Again, without wishing them ill personally, I think that's a healthy development. It'll maybe slow down some who would putatively follow in their footsteps. But I think one of the earlier suggestions was for a loser pays provision of some kind that really ought to be imported into not the criminal law so much as into the civil law for these class action suits that are brought totally baseless. They're strike suits, they're exempt to extort money from large corporations. We're the only country in the world that doesn't have some kind of loser pay provision that obliges a lawyer who brings a specious lawsuit to pay for counsel that had to defend it. And I think that's long overdue, and we almost had it in 1996 until President Clinton vetoed the products liability bill that had large bipartisan support in the Congress.
I have a question for the governor. I think one of the most egregious things I've ever seen, and I, by the way, Ted Stevens, in my opinion, was not a warm, fuzzy guy. I mean, in fact, he wasn't a very nice guy, period, okay? But thank God
he... Is the governor of Alaska?
Yeah. No, this is a senator of Alaska.
Senator.
Thank God he had a lawyer who loved to fight, Brendan Sullivan. But it turns out that the prosecutors withheld exculpatory evidence that would have exonerated him or at least made their case not valid. Now my problem is that's criminal behavior. That's taking a reputation, it's taking a life. Had Brendan not gone after them, this man might very well be in jail today. I can't think of a more severe crime than that, to take away a man's free or a person's freedom for something they didn't do. And again, I'll say it, I've met the man. He's not the kind of guy you want to spend an evening with, not in my opinion. But that's got nothing to do with whether he was innocent or guilty. Yes. But where is the Justice Department today saying to their people, this is not behavior we condone, you should be punished, you will be punished?
Were they punished?
Well, there was, a number of them were fired, but I think that anybody who has spent as much time as I had in the Department of Justice was deeply upset by that case. It was just disgraceful. When you see a case where prosecutors purposely thwart the due process of law that's due each of us as citizens, it calls for some mighty tough medicine. And I suspect, I hope anyway, that we haven't heard the last of that particular case, because that was truly an egregious abuse. And it wasn't inadvertent. I mean, you don't withhold major elements of a case inadvertently. It was a obviously runaway situation and has to be dealt with.
Last question. Right there.
Thank you. At the risk of being another skunk at the lawn party, there is, in fact...
Just tell us who you are, sir.
My name is Roger Moak. Okay. I'm an arbitrator here in New York. There is, in fact, criminal conduct in corporations. And I would, whether anybody here wants to acknowledge that or not, it happens.
I'll acknowledge that right now. Everybody's acknowledged that.
I'd
like the panel's reaction to shifting the focus from going after the corporation, which, you know, a corporation doesn't sin. Individuals in the corporation commit crimes. Mm-hmm. And the problem, in my view, is that the focus ought to be on the individuals, and it ought to be, and the management of those corporations, the boards of those corporations and the managements of those corporations ought to be willing to sacrifice the wrongdoers when there are wrongdoers, rather than run the risk of jeopardizing the corporation's existence by an indictment of the whole corporation. Yeah. I'd just like your reaction to that.
I couldn't agree with you more, because when that fellow or that gal plays fast and loose with the law, my reputation is at stake too. Whether I am factually a party to it, it doesn't matter. In terms of reputation, I served on the board, or I owned a big beast of a company where a guy did a bad thing. And the assumption is I must have known about it, because after all, I was there. But let me give you a for instance, and this is a rather sensitive issue. Should we hold the Catholic Church for criminal behavior because so many priests did so many bad things that I haven't got to tell you what they did? Should we? I don't know. I don't think we should, because there's a lot of priests that play it right, and there's a lot of priests that do what they ought to do. But just like in that case, I think when you say everybody's guilty for the behavior of a person or some people, you're really crossing the line, in my opinion.
So there's another point, too, I think that's very important to emphasize, is that when a huge fine, for example, is levied against a corporation, who pays? The shareholders pay. Exactly. Shareholders that had nothing to do with the wrongdoing. So I think your point is well taken. What we're looking at here is kind of balancing out those interests where the corporate liability and the individual liability have to be assessed on a piecemeal, case-by-case basis.
We need more Dick Thornburgs in government. Trust me when I say that.
Absolutely. I mean that
from the bottom of my heart. But of course, it doesn't hurt that his son and grandson both went to Bucknell.
Yeah,
that sort of gives him a special standing.
No partisanship here. On that note, we're going to have to leave it. I want to thank everyone. Thank Ken for your time and Dick for your time for coming here. It was great.
Thank you.
You're shameless.
I was honored to serve on the board.
Thank you.
I think it is clear how fortunate we are
to believe in the power of ideas.
Supply the common sense and the fresh thinking to the Manhattan Institute.